Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The topic for today is what is happening not just in the United States, but in other countries that allows pedophilia rings, including some very prominent people, not to be arrested. How do they get away with this? We're going to explore this in depth. And I'm going to have two individuals in particular, Andrew Norfolk from the Times of London, one of the most respected journalists in Europe, and John Wedger, who is a member of Major Detective, I believe, with Scotland Yard, and both have something in common. Both were separately from one another investigating allegations that there were large sex rings occurring in selected areas of Great Britain. And a lot of this had to do with child services. It had to do with local constables and police officers and detectives. It also involved high-ranking politicians, past and present, not wanting to investigate this. The question is why? And after they have had their say, I will then explore what is being done in the United States. These are real people, highly credentialed. This is not a Pizzagate. This is not some fake news story. This is the reality of what happens when you have power. Lord Anton said that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And this seems to be the case, at least in the United Kingdom. Now we're going to a discussion by the award-winning journalist at the Times of London, the most respected newspaper in the world, Andrew Norfolk.
On a Friday afternoon, just over 5 years ago, in August 2010, I'd taken a long weekend. I was driving through the Scottish borders en route to Edinburgh, and a news item came on the radio. Court case had just finished at Manchester Crown Court, not far from here. Nine men had been found guilty of multiple sex offences against one 14-year-old girl. She'd been befriended and then passed around these men for sex. And there was an exchange between the young reporter outside the court and the presenter in the studio in London. The presenter clearly knew as little about the case as I did, because I'd not heard anything about it until the item came on. The presenter was saying, "This sounds terrible. These are horrific offences. What was it about these nine men? Did they know each? How did they know each other? Did they have anything in common?" And there was an embarrassed silence, and the young reporter sort of went, "No, I don't think there's any suggestion that these men had anything in common." Now, they hadn't named the men, and I sat there in my car, knowing nothing about the case, thinking very uneasily, "I bet I know something these men have in common." This was 2010. I started on the Times in London in 2000. I moved up to Leeds in 2003 as North East correspondent. And as the years passed, I'd begun to notice what seemed to be a similarity between a number of little cases that were cropping up. Stories that would come across your desk, local newspaper reports, press agency articles. Cases where a number of men, two or more men, were being convicted of sex offences against girls who were almost always aged 12 to 15. The first meeting had been in a public place. It wasn't people they knew. It was a meeting in a bus station in a shopping mall on a street corner. And these kids, young adolescents who were wanting to be treated as more grown up than they were, a lot of them from pretty tough backgrounds, we're going through an initial befriending, grooming process, and then alcohol, drugs, being lured into a world where they were suddenly completely out of their depth. And in the worst cases, were being put into cars, taken to houses for so-called parties, and a lot of men were waiting to have sex with them. There was one other thing these cases had in common. It was very difficult to avoid noticing that the names of almost all the offenders were Muslim names. And that was really weird, because almost every form of sexual offending against children that we know in this country is overwhelmingly white men usually acting on their own. Abuse in the family, in institutions, against boys, against prepubescent girls, online. White. But this was different, and yet each case was being treated as a one-off, totally isolated, no pattern. And that day in the car in the Borders, I said to myself, when I get back to Leeds, I'm going to check. And if these nine men are Muslim names, then I've got to get over my fear that this is a story it's impossible to cover because it is the far right's dream story. Innocent white girls, evil, dark-skinned men. How do you cover that? But I can't carry on ignoring it. And sure enough, when I got back, I looked up. It was indeed as I'd thought. The next day, I sent a very long email to the news editor in London. Said, look, I think there's something going on here. We need to look into it. Will you give me some time? And he gave me what turned out to be 3 months. Most of that time was spent trawling online, searching through newspaper archives and local libraries, trying to find cases that fitted the pattern. Nothing to do with the names of the men who were being convicted, but the cases that fitted that model. And we came up in the end with 17 cases since the late 90s, 13 different towns and cities, 56 men convicted. 3 of the 56 were white, 53 were Asian names, 50 of them were Muslim names, and when we looked into each case, the overwhelming majority were Pakistani Muslim. Okay, so we had a kind of evidential base, but what the hell are you going to do about it? We needed to start talking to people, and so I tried to start talking to police forces, to specialists, to experts who look after children, to government departments, and there was a complete wall of silence. All we get, if anything, was a terse statement, you know, ethnicity, culture has absolutely no relevance whatsoever to this pattern of offending. In the end, I found one small charity which worked with the families of victims, and through them, I got to know some of the families and to understand that the court cases where people were actually being prosecuted were actually a tiny, tiny minority, because in most cases, parents had been trying really hard to get help for their kids. They were going and knocking on doors. They were pleading with social services, with police to do something, and nothing was happening. Eventually, we were ready to publish, and we published that first story in January 2011. A whole of the front page and 4 pages inside. Within a few days, the government had ordered a national inquiry. Within 2 days, Jack Straw, the former Home Secretary, went on Newsnight and said that some young Pakistani men in his Blackburn constituency viewed white girls as easy meat, which created further headlines. I was called down to London for my very first ever one-to-one meeting with the editor of the Times. I'd been told he was quite pleased with the impact of the story, and I thought I was going to get a pat on the back and be told I'd done a good job. Instead, he told me this was now going to be my full-time job. I thought we'd done it, but he said we were going to carry on keeping running stories about this until, and he pointed from his office out through the glass around into the newsroom, until the day comes when every single one of your colleagues arrives for work one morning, picks up the front page of the Times and says, oh my God, not another bloody story about child sexual exploitation. That's the day, he said, when I'll know we're finally starting to make a difference. You're going to carry on writing about this until we're satisfied that every public body in England has the knowledge and systems in place to protect children and prosecute offenders, however long it takes. Well, it took 4 years. We told more individual family stories. One of the very first was from a grandfather who rang from Rotherham, who wanted to talk about his granddaughter. 1 month after her 13th birthday, she gone to school and then gone missing, and the school had rung her mum, who'd immediately rung the police, who'd said, don't worry, love, she'll turn up soon as she gets hungry. She didn't turn up that afternoon, that evening. And at 2:30 in the morning, the next morning, a woman on the other side of Rotherham had picked up the phone and dialed 999 because she'd heard a young girl screaming in the house next door. Police had gone round to the house. They found this 13-year-old girl with another young girl. She was almost completely naked. She was blind drunk, and she was with seven adult Pakistani men. She was drunk and leery. And South Yorkshire Police arrested the 13-year-old girl for being drunk and disorderly. They took her back to the station, put her in the cells, eventually charged her, and she was convicted. They didn't even question the men as to why they were in a house with a 13-year-old girl who was nearly naked in the early hours of the morning. Another early story was about Rochdale, and in the spring of 2012 came the first big court case we covered. By now, this pattern and this story was getting quite a lot of attention, but there were still many days when we were the only newspaper in court. It was a trial that lasted several weeks, and on one of those days, we learned something pretty extraordinary. One of the victims was a girl from Essex, but she'd been put into a children's home in Rotherham, and she was the only resident of that children's home. I'd never heard of solo care children's homes. In 2 months in that home, she'd gone missing 15 times, periods ranging from a day to a fortnight, and on one of those missing nights, she'd been taken to a house, put blind drunk in an upstairs bedroom, and cars had started arriving from all across Greater Manchester. Men were queuing on the stairs and on the landing outside the bedroom. And the jury heard that 50 men had had sex with that girl in one night. She was a child. When I looked into this children's home, it turned out that Rochdale had more than 40 solo care homes, each supposedly offering specialist 24/7 care to one child. Essex County Council was paying more than £250,000 a year to place that child there. We discovered a whole pattern of private care companies, many of them owned by private equity firms, buying very cheap properties in the north and the Midlands. And vulnerable kids were being shipped up from London and the southeast. Private companies were charging extortionate prices. And these kids were being placed, many of them right smack bang in the middle of sex grooming hotspots. That story is just one example of some of the spin-offs that came along the 4 years, but it led to an urgent government review, a significant shake-up of children's home regulations. By now, more and more criminal inquiries were being launched, but I kept coming back to Rotherham because something about what the police had done in that house really troubled me. We told and got to know some families so well in that town, and I got to know the case files, and it just seemed extraordinary that the authorities knew so much and did so little. I couldn't work out if it was just these isolated cases I was hearing about or whether it was something more. And eventually came the big breakthrough for the investigation, without question the most single important day, which was the day I drove to an address somewhere in South Yorkshire. I waited, and eventually another car drove up. I opened my boot, the driver opened theirs, and two very large sagging cardboard boxes were transferred from their car to mine. Inside those boxes were hundreds of confidential documents. Internal papers, police intelligence reports, social services case files. Those papers gave us the chance to tell a very detailed and damning story, how for more than a decade, South Yorkshire Police and Rotherham Council had known exactly what was happening. They knew the girls. They knew the names of the men, their nicknames, their home addresses, their car registration numbers, the places they were taking these children, and they had effectively sat back, shrugged their shoulders, and done nothing.
In my naivety, I thought that when we published that story in September 2012, those at the top of those two organizations would be so shocked and ashamed and horrified that they would immediately announce inquiries to try to get to the bottom of what had happened. Rotherham Council was indeed horrified, and an inquiry was launched, but not into their own failings. All they wanted to know was how we'd got hold of the documents. They'd already tried to get a High Court injunction to block an earlier story. Now they asked the police to launch a criminal inquiry into the leak. They also hired a firm of solicitors to investigate the security breach. As for the police, they not only dismissed all criticism, but publicly accused the Times of exploiting the victims. Those authorities were in complete denial, so we kept digging, and a year later, in August 2013, we published the story that eventually shamed the council into commissioning the independent inquiry, whose report was published in August last year. Rufus was telling you about it. It wasn't just the numbers, 1,400 children. It was the clear evidence the inquiry had found of horrific crimes having been ignored or suppressed by the authorities. As Rufus said, suddenly Rotherham became headline news globally. China, Australia, Canada, you name it. And when I think back to what the editor said to me 4 years ago, we're going to keep on until, the council's chief executive told a parliamentary committee in evidence that the reason the council felt forced to commission that inquiry that ended up having such huge repercussions was because, quote, the Times wouldn't leave us alone. In the outcry that ensued, several senior people lost their jobs. Then the ruling Labour cabinet resigned en masse. Finally, the local authority was found not fit for purpose, and it's now run by a team of government-appointed commissioners. I think this story is an example of why newspapers matter. For years and years, people in that town had been desperately concerned by what was going on. They'd tried their very best to raise the alarm. Young girls and their families had pleaded with the police. Frontline workers told their bosses. Internal reports were written, seminars held, letters sent to chief constables, MPs, government departments, and absolutely nothing changed. And finally, when all else failed, someone very brave decided in desperation to place their trust in journalism.
Andrew Norfolk. And this brings us up to the end of his segment. Let me just recapitulate so that we put this in proper and honest and objective perspective. In just one small community in the United Kingdom, we had rampant, unbridled pedophilia, all underage girls, and they were being sexually exploited. The police knew, the council knew, those in authority all, it turns out, knew. Now, why they did not do anything, we do not know. But they didn't. And almost always when someone in authority knows that crime has been committed, especially such a heinous crime, and does nothing, it's because, more often than not, they have been paid to look the other way, not get involved. Or because someone very powerful has stated, don't get involved. And I want to commend Andrew Norfolk from The Times and the editor-in-chief of The Times for having the courage to take on this story. And as he said, the only reason anything ever came from this, the inquiry, is because they wouldn't go away. Today, in the United States, we have no such media. Do you really think that the New York Times, which gave us Judith Miller and the justifications for the war in Iraq, do you really believe that the people at CNN or MSNBC, all fully intellectually capable of doing honest reporting and choose to do completely biased journalism? We're seeing it now. I had a gentleman on my show who wrote a book about the Philadelphia experience, talking about how a very powerful politician and people in Washington, D.C. had a deal with people inside Boys Town to take boys and girls, young ones, underage, to Washington, D.C. so they could be sexually exploited, then brought back. Nobody would believe them. When their story finally got out, both the boy and girl were questioned by the FBI and charged with offering false stories, even though there was confirming evidence. They both went to jail. You heard here that who went to jail? The 50 men who gangbanged a woman in one night? No, not one. A young girl? Yes, she went to jail. That shows you how corrupt systems can be. But this is not the first situation in Great Britain. Former Prime Minister of Great Britain was also alleged to be a part of a pedophilia ring. Members of the House of Lords, members of the House of Commons. Margaret Thatcher was aware of this, but nothing happened, except a few of the people who were going to testify were killed. They were murdered. So this was all swept under the carpet. And think of how many people in power were only now finding out have abused their power. Not just with pedophilia, but think of Hillary Clinton. We have at least 13 women, minimally, who claim that they were sexually abused, physically, or raped by Bill Clinton. Instead of a true investigation occurring, the women were all vilified, and the left accepted it, enabled it. At no point was Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton held accountable for what they did in Arkansas before he was Attorney General, why he was Attorney General, and why he was Governor. We did the investigations. I did the investigations. We were the first radio program in America to broadcast those in-depth investigations. And I was warned at the time by a very powerful couple, one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, Democratic fundraising couple at that time in New York. They were friends, and they said, they're being groomed for the White House. And why, I asked. Because the people in power behind the scenes know that whatever they want, the Clintons will abide and provide. They were selected. Now they'll be elected. So I had a chance to see firsthand the complete and total corruption of the democratic process, the destruction and evisceration of ethics, morality within the Democrat corporate movement, and so many good liberals turning their head because they didn't want to get involved in this. So we have the same problem in the United States. Now we're going to hear from a separate person. This is a chief of detectives. His is different, but comes to similar conclusions. And this person is John Wedger, W-E-D-G-E-R, giving his story.
And what I must say that this isn't the first time that I've been shut down for exposing child abuse offences. A couple of years prior to that, if I may jump the timeline, I was on an inquiry looking into transient paedophiles that had failed to register, and I found out that they were residing on canal boats within the inland waterway network of the UK. They had information from within the prison service that there were two paedophiles that were living on boats. Now, boats had a lot of poignancy in as much as there was freedom to travel. The canal network was very, very old and therefore didn't get policed. And children like boats. And the BBC had a programme at the time which sort of It was to do with two little dolls that lived on a canal boat called Rosie and Jim, and it was tied in at the same time as I was looking into this. So kids were drawn to the waterways. I'll get back to the main story, but the reason for telling this bit was that I was told that there were two sex offenders. I was asked to look into it as a field intelligence officer, and if I found another two within a set period of time, they'd be happy. Within that period of time, I'd found 90. I came into work, and I was told by a high-ranked officer that the inquiry had been shut down, and the reason given was that they couldn't afford the funding for me. But I had been approached by a Scotland Yard detective who told me, he said, when you investigate any crime and you do well at it, you get praised. When you look into child abuse cases, the opposite happens. Be very careful. He then told me about a cabinet minister that they'd investigated on a few occasions, and on each occasion they've been shut down. So I was aware that this had gone on. When I questioned the senior officer about, you know, the real reason, he told me, John, I'm so sorry, it's come from high up, there's nothing I can do, and promised me any job I wanted. So I moved on to the vice unit. So I was expecting to be praised for what I found out. Each day a new child would be found, and it was just spiralling. I was brought before someone who is now a very, very high-ranked officer in the UK indeed. And he sat me down and he said, John, I've got to be very upfront with you. And I said, well, I'd like to be upfront with you, Governor, as well. And he said, you know, you're out of all the officers I've got here, there was about, I don't know, 40 officers. He said, you're the second best one I've got, which was a good accolade. He said, but unfortunately, you've dug too deep. What the hell have you done? Now, on a personal level, since the beginning of 2000, I'd brought up four children on my own, and this was common knowledge within my unit. And he said to me, if you ever disclose what you found out, you will lose your home, your children, and your job. You must shut the F up. And he said, you will be thrown to the wolves. You have no idea who and what you are dealing with. He said, I'm warning you now, you must back away. And then he said something quite strange, and he said that if you say a word of this, and even if you make a complaint, it will come back to me and it will go in the bin. I and no one else will ever betray fellow rank. Shut your mouth. So I walked away from that investigation, and I moved on. I was offered to stay, but I couldn't. What was very strange was that the main witness, the young girl that came forward, was found dead in the street very shortly afterwards on a suspicious drug overdose, which sort of compounded matters. I then moved on to work on child abuse investigations, which is slightly different to Vice, and I can, if I have the time, explain why there is this compartmentalisation within these institutions. And it's all down to remits and justifiable reasons for actually doing nothing as opposed to doing something. I went on to a child abuse unit in one of the poorer boroughs of London, and I was asked if I would like, as well as an investigator, take on a second role dealing with various sort of issues they have. And I was told you'll get a day here and there to go to a meeting. And I asked to look into if there anyone was dealing with children's homes. I was told no, there was an officer that was dealing with children's homes, but she left 2 years ago. And she didn't do anything anyway because nothing happens. There's no problem. And I asked this sergeant, are there any problems with child prostitution within the kids' homes? And she said, what are you on about? No, of course not. I got a list, and this is almost real time as I'm telling it now. I got a list faxed through to me from social services with all the children's homes. There was 26 kids' homes. I picked up the phone and I spoke to the fella and I asked him how many kids they have. And on an average, there's about five children reside in these children's homes. And I said, no, I'm not pointing the finger. No one's in any trouble. How many of these children do you lose at the weekend? Which is the usual pattern of missing, you know, when kids go missing. And so out of the five, we lose three. And I said, no, honestly, what happens to them? They went, oh, they're being pimped out. So I'd found this officer that had dealt with it for years had found none. Within this, honestly, this was the time, as we're speaking now, within this period of minutes, I'd found three. By the end of that day, I'd found six. By the end of 3 days to 5 days, I'd found 50. I held a meeting with all the concerned agencies, which involved charities, which involved NGOs, which involved social services, and I highlighted the problem. And I was then harangued, really. I was attacked verbally by head of children's services for this borough, saying to me, "What the effing hell have you done?" And I said, "Well, you knew about these kids." I said, "Yeah, but they hadn't come notice, so we're not worried." The children were making money, so therefore the children weren't worried. The children had a boyfriend, which was their pimp. Therefore, they thought this was love. And the children were also using drugs, so therefore they want to continue to use drugs. So they weren't coming to notice. So therefore social services had written them off, despite the fact that the children's homes would constantly be getting in the logs that they were being picked up and they were going missing. These were regular missing persons. The police have a missing persons unit. They say so many thousands of kids go missing every year. They do, but a lot of them do return. But what is never looked into is what happens when they're going missing. They are working as prostitutes. And again, the child abuse units won't look into them because they say it's not interfamilial, because it's someone else pimping them out. The bigger cities have vice units. Vice units will not deal with them because they say that these are kids subject to care orders. So no one looks into it, and it goes on and it festers and it festers. And then funny enough, after this meeting, I was shut down and moved again. I then came forward a couple of years later. I was actually genuinely concerned that I would lose my children. I know how powerful the police are, and I know what they're capable of, having worked with them. I blew the whistle a few years ago, and I was told that my allegations would be taken at the highest level. I asked to speak to a high-ranked female detective, and this was questioned. And then they did get me a high-ranked female detective, and she said to me, "Why are you talking to me and no one else?" I said, "Because you cannot roll up your trouser leg." And she said, "I understand exactly what you mean." They instigated allegations of corruption against high-ranked officers. When you investigate these crimes, as a witness and informant as I was, you're meant to get regular updates every 28 days. I never received one in 3 years. The matter was passed from one unit to another unit. It ended up with the IPCC, who again did nothing and failed to update me despite the fact that they had corroborating evidence. I met with other police whistleblowers via a few concerned MPs. One of them was a lady called Maggie Oliver, who had exposed the scandal in Rochdale. Another one was a man called Lenny Harper, who had exposed the horrendous goings on at a kid's home called Hope de la Garenne in Jersey. Each one of them echoed each other. They both said, "They're going to come for you, and they will come hard." And I said, "What do I expect?" They said, "Right, you will be served with gross misconduct papers. You will be interviewed. They will find against you. You will be sacked, and you will probably face a court case and may go to jail." Now, the threats that was echoed to me, "You'll lose your home, your job, your children." At the same time, the police stopped paying me. I went without wages for nearly 3 years. I had four children. Then what happened was that they served me gross misconduct papers, and I was told what it will be for data protection violations, which seems to be a common occurrence. I got served with numerous data protection violations. Each one could have given me a 2-year prison sentence. And this continued and continued. Now, what also happened during this period was that one of my children was involved in a life-changing and catastrophic accident in which he was initially declared dead. They revived him. He was on life support for many, many months. I got a call from the hospital to attend the hospital where they had actually lost him. He'd been dead for 10 minutes. So I was called down to the hospital to basically identify him. I turned up and they had actually revived him within this period, but they deemed him as brain dead, although he was on full 100% life support. A colleague of mine was so concerned, as I had no money, and for 3 days I slept in my car and stayed by my son's side My son actually made signs of life, and I was able to return home. But my colleague had brought this to the attention of senior officers, just saying, you know, you've got to help this man. He's done nothing wrong. The Met Police's response to this, when I got home, they'd sent two child protection officers round to interview my youngest boy on allegations that I'd left him home alone while I was with my dying son. So the threats of you will lose your home, your job and your children rang true. I persisted. I refused to give up. And I set up a forum, a working group with all the police whistleblowers. And it extended and it branched out. The IPCC stopped investigating the crime. I was meant to be given a full breakdown of what went on. And I was given a one paragraph letter and told not to contact them again. We're not investigating it. Their answer was that the three high ranked officers that I'd accused of corruption, they went and spoke to them and they denied it. And that was the extent of their investigation. And all them years as an investigator, I've been doing it wrong. You've just got to ask someone if they've done it. And if they say no, that's it. And that was what they expected me to swallow and told me not to contact them again. I took the matter to the policing minister at the time, a member of the Privy Council and a member of the government's cabinet. He met with me and he was actually, to my surprise, appalled. He arranged for a meeting with the Home Office. The Home Office then got their independent investigation team involved and stated that there will be an independent investigation into my claims. And they deemed that the Met Police and the IPCC had failed and they were looking into it. I was summoned to a meeting and it was a fully recorded meeting and it was witnessed, and in which the Cabinet Minister handed my paperwork over to the Home Office officials, and that was an official handover of the paperwork, which I supplied to him. They then gave me their assurances that they will be in touch with me and give me a 24-hour contact number and said they will investigate this independently. I never heard from them again. They have since denied receiving any paperwork. When pushed, they admitted they did receive it, but have now lost it. We are seeing police failings in respect to child prostitution hemorrhaging in this country, but we are seeing them on a provincial level. We're seeing them in Rochdale, Blackpool, Rotherham. We're seeing them in Oxford, Aylesbury, Swindon, all on a provincial level. London is one of the largest urban conurbations in the Western world. It has got one of the biggest police forces. We haven't heard one thing about organised child prostitution in London, and the reason being is that those high up have been covering it up, and this goes right to the heart. I was met with, as I said, Lenny Harper. Children were killed at Haute de la Garenne, in which Lenny Harper had forensic evidence, which was then went missing. And he said to me, be careful, what you're looking at will go right to the heart of the establishment. I sat down with the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick, and I explained to her what was going on. And I explained the dynamics of how you groom a child. I said, I can take a child out of a care system. I can groom that child. I can have sex with that child. I can get my friends to have sex with that child. I can pimp that child out. You have not appointed one officer to investigate that. Yet if I leant over my fence and called my neighbour a derogatory term, I'd lose my home, my job, I'd be signing on a register, and I'd never work for the Met Police again. How is that justifiable? How is it justifiable? I now work with victims and survivors of abuse. I help out with recovering alcoholics and drug addicts. I'm working in collusion now with one of the most notorious gangsters the UK had, and the convicted murderer, Chris Lambriano. And I've never had such support and compassion from these people, yet the police would have had me swinging from a rope if they've had their own way. When we look at our prison service, we look at our prison system, 75% of inmates are illiterate. This is in the UK, they're illiterate. 75% of our inmates have come from abused backgrounds. We have a recidivism rate of 75%. The system does not work. child abuse is at the root of all of this. Child abuse units, when I was on them, I've worked on many specialist units in the police. I've worked on units that have been anti-government. I've worked on units that have been financial crime. You get given a car. You get given an expense account. You get given unlimited overtime. When I was on child abuse, we had a car between 10 of us. I worked with three alcoholics because the work was so horrendous and impactive. We had no respite. We were worked till we were dropping. And we would have appointments to see psychiatrists every 6 months, but they weren't to sign us off. They were to keep us going. Say, oh, you're all right, you're all right. Keep going, keep going. They deliberately underfund anything to do with child abuse. Deliberately, and it's done for a reason. I had many informants that came from the street. They were beggars. They were drug addicts. They had all been sexually abused as children. One of them told me of a scenario when he was in a kid's home at the age of 4, was raped on his first night by a Catholic priest. He then went on to be raped daily and whipped and beaten. He became a drug addict and he ended up as a rent boy on the street at an area of the West End where I used to work as a vice copper. And that was what was classed as the meat rack in Piccadilly Circus, where young boys were openly picked up for the purpose of prostitution. It was known about. He went to get in a car and he was in trouble. He needed drugs, so he needed the money. And he had a pimp, and he said, a pimp wasn't a bad thing. A pimp actually looked after me. I was safer with a pimp on the street than I was in a kid's home. He went to get into a car, which was a white Rolls Royce with two men in it. And his pimp said, don't go in that car. The last two boys went in there. They killed them. We never saw them again. He gesticulated for the driver to drive around the block. And his pimp didn't see this. His pimp thought he'd walked away, but he didn't. He got in the car. He was then taken to a very affluent part of London called Hampstead. He was then subjected to 3 days of torture and sexual violence, in which he said that they knew that they'd killed him. And he said they dumped his lifeless body on Hampstead Heath by the Royal Free Hospital, believing he was dead. And he said, what shocked me more, John, was the fact that these two men, they were well-dressed, they had a big house, and they were actually getting ready to go to their niece's wedding whilst they were dropping my lifeless body off, perceived lifeless body off, on a bit of heath ground. Yet it goes on consistently. Back in 2003, the justice system brought in what they call the Bad Character Act. Before, you could never bring in someone's previous convictions within a legal trial in the UK, unless it was a very, very serious one. And then it was very difficult. There were too many legal parameters. They brought this in and everyone thought that it was a coup. It was a step forward in gaining justice. But when you commit minor acts of shoplifting, it's dishonest crime. You are then deemed a dishonest person. Every person I dealt with, every street person, every crack-taking prostitute had been abused as a child. They all committed dishonest crime to stay alive. Right? They shoplifted. They pimped themselves. Whatever they did it to survive, to buy their drugs, to carry on. So whenever they were brought in a trial as a witness, they were instantly deemed as dishonest. And this is what we're seeing now when people are coming forward. They are rubbish and they're broken. And one of the startling things that occurred was back in the beginning of 2000, they brought over Mayor Giuliano from New York to preach to us on a thing called the broken window theory. And what his theory was, that if there was an area that of depravity that had a broken window or a damaged bus shelter, to clean it up, smarten it up, you won't get your drug dealers, you won't get your shoplifters, you won't get, you know, your robberies, that all these crimes that are in the periphery around sort of poverty and everything else. And therefore, your society gets better. Smarten these broken windows up. It was naive at the least. Where is this timeline taken back? The fact is they're doing drugs because they're paying for heroin. They're on heroin because heroin is an analgesic. It's a painkiller. Pain can be mental, emotional, as well as physical. And the majority of them were there doing the drugs because they come from the care system. The care system that had appallingly let them down and that they had been sexually abused and they had no way of processing the damage that had been done to them. Our judicial system sets them up to fail. It follows them through from cradle to grave. These kids are known about, yet nothing happens. They grow up, they become bad in class, they become violent. They get reported to the social services, yet the problem is still not addressed. They then commit minor acts and end up before the juvenile courts. Again, nothing is done. They commit then heavier acts, robberies or whatever, and end up before the magistrates' courts, yet nothing is done. They end up before the crown courts, and ultimately they end up going before the coroner's courts. Yet throughout all this circle, nothing ever breaks it. The people that are paid a good living wage to stop this are failing it. And sometimes it's deliberate, sometimes it's apathy, sometimes it's ignorance. I've just come back from Rotherham, a small steel town in the northwest cluster of the UK. I met with a social worker who had exposed the child prostitution problem. She ran an outreach group and the kids were coming to her, and then one would tell her, another and she looked into it. It was organised prostitution. It's a small little town. 2,000 children were being pimped out. She got attacked. She got attacked from the police. Her husband nearly lost his job. It nearly brought her to this point of suicide. And this is what they do. It's orchestrated and it was manipulated at the highest echelons. And she said it was coming from the high-ranking officers. And it was. But yet all they would offer up would be the lower ranking officers for some form of malfeasance, whatever. But it is being orchestrated at the very top. My investigation showed a strong link with high-ranked officers and organised criminals. I spoke with another child abuse investigator, a quite high-ranked officer, and I spoke to him from Manchester. Again, he had a proven link between high-ranked officers and organised criminals and child prostitution there. We had a glimmer of hope in the form of a chief constable, a commissioner of police for a county called Wiltshire. The man's name is Mike Veal. He stood up and he investigated child prostitution, child trafficking, child abuse, everything else, but involved former Prime Minister Ted Heath. He turned around in Parliament and he said, if they can attack me, because he come under attack. And he said he came under attack from places he didn't even know existed. And he said, if they can attack me, God knows what they'll do to John Wedger, which in a way was a bit of an accolade. But, and I spoke to him and he said, it's just vile, John. It is vile. I then looked at how many police officers, the policeman's biggest fear is going to prison. And they know it. They know it. This is deliberate. What we're looking at is deliberate. I was a good guy. When you're a policeman, you take an oath, and your oath is, I will act without fear or without favour. Someone said to me, John, do not base your own bravery on others. Don't judge others for the lack of bravery and commitment shown. I do not see myself as brave. I see myself as a man who believes in protecting the vulnerable, doing God's work, and doing what my oath said, to act without fear or without favour. They are going against their oath. And I said, we will look at this word fear, shall we? What are they frightened of? Telling the truth. Where the real fear lies is this young child laying in a kid's home at night and they're coming and they're taking the blankets from over him. That's the real fear. You know, we need to get a grip. You come under attack and you do come under attack and it's painful when it hurts. And it does. And it does do its best to destroy you. Maggie Oliver said to me, John, I was going to prison. The CPS turned round and said, we've got enough evidence. If you don't come to some agreement, admit to whatever, then you're found guilty, you will go to prison. She had to tell her children she was going to prison. The CPS in the end with me turned around and said, John Wedger's mitigation was so powerful, we could never convict him. I said to them, I submitted my statement prior to any trial. I wrote a statement and I gave it to Chris Dick and said, here's my statement. Whatever you say I've done, I've done. I don't care. But I will not be tried by you. I will be tried in a crown court. And I will be tried by my peers and I will be tried fairly. I've done nothing wrong. And I listed every single person from the bottom right the way up to the top who was involved, who knew about it, who did nothing, who then did nothing, who did nothing. This went right up to Bernard Hogan Howe. And now to Chris Dick. Bernard Hogan Howe knew about this. the campaign of bullying on me was orchestrated under his command. He has now been appointed by the House of Lords to look into child grooming gangs and how they existed. Well, I might save him the trouble. I can do that for him. You know, it is wrong. It is wrong. They're looking now. I was asked to make an address to Lord Pearson's office regarding the presence of grooming gangs and how it works, how it's the mechanics of it all. They're looking at it from a very sort of religious background, that it's Muslim gangs. This is a bigger picture. This is a bigger picture. Kids are a commodity. And one of the things which I want to refer back to is yourself, Commissioner, to my right, mentioned about the Marc Dutroux. Whenever I give a talk, you have to make things relevant. We don't look at the third world and how they're dealing with things, because there are different people. They looked, if they drive on a different side of the road, they look a different colour. Let's look at what we got on our backyard. One of the countries that's demographically very similar to us is Belgium. In living memory, it went on in Belgium, you know, and it went on with Marc Dutroux. And the kids that came forward were so pigeonholed in what they could talk about. Anything that went outside of Marc Dutroux, they weren't allowed. I think it was 23 to 25 civilian witnesses died in the lead up to the trial.
90.
Unbelievable.
In total, 90.
Absolutely unbelievable, yep. And then the people took the power back. They blew the windows out with the fire engines of the parliamentary office, and then they sprayed horse manure all over the building, and they took to the streets, didn't they? Half a million people. Half a million people. And what do? We only kick off when someone throws a cat in a wheelie bin. If we allow our children to be attacked and preyed on in this way, we have failed as a decent and moral society. And we are doing that, and we are doing nothing. It has to stop, and they have to back. I don't want no glory, but people like myself, we need backing, and we need it.
Absolutely.
And that person was Chief Detective John Weger, W-E-D-G-E-R, and he was testifying just now before a international tribunal. And did you hear all that he said? That he was threatened, that his family was threatened, if he simply exposed the grooming environments. 2,000 young kids in one small town, in a poor town in northern England, 2,000, and yet the authorities had done nothing. They knew all about it. As he said, everyone knew from the lowest to the highest position of what was occurring. And instead of doing the right thing, it was covered up. How often have you seen that done in America? It is endemic, the corruption within the police, within the Justice Department. We're seeing that now with the deep state, with the people controlling the FBI and the Justice Department, the CIA, the National Security Agency. So everywhere, unfortunately. And why? Why do they not do the right thing? Some individuals certainly do. But you haven't heard this anywhere in America. This is the first time you've heard this information. These two people didn't exist until you just heard them. Now, these are real people, a top journalist and a top honest police officer, a detective, who spent decades at their work. And yet not a word about this, not on 60 Minutes, not on 2020. Because once you open that door, you can't control what comes through it. And then there are going to be questions asked about powerful people and how they've gotten away with what they've gotten away with and why others didn't come forward to challenge them. And also, in Great Britain, if there's any possibility that the government, Miss May, the Prime Minister, could be accused of Islamophobia, then that shuts down that entire level of inquiry. And yet the people responsible for one of those grooming groups of over 1,400 girls, all underage, which represents pedophilia, were Pakistani. Not a word. So that's what we're dealing with. We're at the end of this program.